Your spiritual nature cannot be separate from his. How could your basic mind possibly not have common ground? The existence of states of happiness and misery, superior and inferior conditions, depends solely on whether or not one has developed determination, whether or not one has met an enlightened teacher. And the capping verse from Kazan says this: how can we see this story? All at once, he raises infinity. Never has he clung to anything beyond him. So I would urge you all to, if you have a copy, to pick up Kazan's Nenko Ryoku and check that out. So tonight, I think we could say we have a vision or an image of a bodhisattva, ourselves, practicing, making this effortless effort that Sherdu mentions in his lecture, having the determination to realize, to trust the teachings of no self, impermanence, and emptiness. So the lines tonight are interesting. The last line of the verse we studied last was, will this hut perish or not? In the Chinese, it's the first line of this next verse. So will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. So line 13, will this hut perish or not? So it's interesting, in this line and the next line, the character for ruin is repeated twice. And as a reader of poetry, when someone repeats a word twice, it kind of emphasizes it. Here in two lines, this word ruin is used four times. So clearly imperishability, ruin, decay is right on the mind of Sherdu when he's laying this out. But it raises the question for us, what does this mean? What is perishing? What is ruin? What is decay? What is the form, our body, that rots, that changes, is being ruined before our eyes? Sherdu's line, what meets the eye is the way, comes to mind immediately. And line 14 then, perishable or not, the original master is present. So an alternative translation from Mitchell says, if you say my hut looks shabby, I'll answer that the one mind abides right where it is. And whether it's rotten or not rotten doesn't really matter, because the speaker, the one who's inhabiting this hut, ourselves, we recognize that, I like the Bob Dylan song, everything is broken. Everything is broken. I was at a Dharma talk that Zoketsu gave at one point where he was focusing on where we live in the world. And he made the point over and over again, even as something is new, it's already broken because it enters the world of transition. It enters the world of impermanence. But here what Sherdu is raising is that the original master and present is present. It kind of both incorporating and in contrast to this impermanence. The translation has the original master. That character can also be read as the host, and we'll raise that issue later when we talk about the host and the guest line. My colleague, Mr. Hansen, has provided a little translation for this line that would be alternatively, the master has been here from the beginning, or the host was originally here. So even before the hut, before the idea of a hut, before our self-concept, before the concept of concept, the original host was here. One name for the original master is our original being. In the framework of the Mahayana teachings, the term Dharmakaya is used, part of one of the three bodies of the Buddha. And as I was kind of getting prepared for this evening, I remembered that I had read this essay from early talks by Suzuki Roshi in this anthology called, I think it's called Wind Notes. And he presented a talk back in Tassajara in 1968 about the three forms of the Buddha, the Triyaka, in which he presents the Dharmakaya as the Dharma body of the Buddha, the perpetual, potential, fundamental, undeveloped Buddha body, the original master. Another commentator calls this one way of conceptualizing the unconceptualizable Dharmakaya as big mind, unified existence that lies beyond all concepts, the all complete perfection in which animate and inanimate forms, as well as the moral order, arise. And in our tradition, this is embodied in the Buddha before, the first of the seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, the Vairochana Buddha, who's characterized as like the sun. And I think we'll sort of pick that image up again when we talk about the shining window at the base of the fir trees, of the pine trees. Suzuki Roshi goes on to tie this original master to our practice of sitting. He tells us, when we say just sit, it includes actually all of the activity, all the potential activity which we have. We remain in an inactive state, but we have infinite potentiality. In this sense, our practice includes everything. When we sit, we're just sitting. Each one of us is sitting, and each one of us is the Dharmakaya Buddha. But even though we are sitting, we breathe, our heart is beating, so we are in activity, which are the other two parts of the Triyaka, the Sambhogakaya Buddha and the Nirmanakaya Buddha. We understand reality in this way, he tells us. So I'd like to open the floor for a few minutes for comments and thoughts that you might have about these two lines again. Will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present. What is that telling us? What is that saying to you tonight as you've read this poem over and over again, hopefully? So the floor is open for thoughts or comments that you may have. I think you can just unmute yourself to speak if there are words to be had. Tell us.
So the opening line about will this hut perish or not, and the we've been talking about the hut as being us, being our lives, and it doesn't seem like there's, you know, we don't doubt that we will perish. Maybe in the moment we do, but we seem to be continuously worrying about if we're going to be able to maintain this way of life that we have right now.
Repairing the roof, repairing the grass hut.
I think the original master is present, is Buddha nature. We may be perishable in some way, but Buddha nature is not. It's right. Eternal. Mm-hmm. Place.
It's even beyond perishable or perishable, I think, is the teaching we have.
In Buddhist teaching, impermanence is considered a fact, the basis of the whole structure. So perishable or not, that question in some ways is already answered in terms of the material aspects. Mm-hmm. Now that the or not, so perishable is yes, we will perish. And the or not is we are the unborn. We have not been born, we will not die. And so to hold both these truths equally, even though they seem to be in conflict, is one of those interesting Zen games, isn't it?
living in the paradox. Tim?
The or not is kind of like a setup, you know, if you're dumb enough to pay attention to the or not. I also think it the connection to the previous stanza is worth keeping in mind. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess it is arranged this way in the Chinese. There are stanzas of four lines, but the way it says the previous lines that blah, 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 the way the great vehicle Bodhisattva trusts without doubt, and the middling or lowly can't help wondering, and we could put a colon there, will this hut perish or not? Like, is that a worry of the middling or lowly? But again, yeah, Krista's point is great. Like, then why do we bother with perishable or not in two lines in a row when we all know it's perishable? Why do we even need to bring that up? What's Shirto's intention in sort of baiting us with the idea that it could be not perishable?
It's interesting, especially in light of the great vehicle Bodhisattva trust without doubt. So all of a sudden bringing this forward and ramming it home twice over, perishable, rotting, imperishable. It's a kind of, it's almost like asking us, are you sure? Or is how do we view that in light of what he lays out a few lines earlier?
I've just going back to that former stanza, I was reading the middling or lowly can't help wondering as being more the diluted aspects of our perspective, our way of seeing things, which would then make that, will this hut perish or not, that unending question make more sense in that context.
And I think the middling or lowly, contrary to what Connell says, he's annoyed by those words, but that's us, you know, that's really includes everyone. We're anxious. We don't know, we don't have the answer. And this is trying to say, actually, we do have the answer, but it's hard to keep it. Comes, but it's hard to hold it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm also wondering, because the first part of the poem is talking about building the hut, and that's like we all build our lives and our egos and our sense of separate self and what we think our future is and what our past is. And then we know it's perishable, but there's part of us that just really wants to hang on to that. And it's almost like even looking at death, it's like, but will I still be alive? Like what happens after death? Will it still be me? And there's endless debates about that because none of us actually know the answer yet. But then saying the original master is present, it's kind of like it's that original part is always with us anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of like giving us hope, right? The original perishable or not, the original master is present. And I also thought that talking about a vehicle, Bodhisattva trusts without doubt. And then the next line is the middling or lowly cannot help wondering. So if we've got our wits about us, we can be, we're part of the great vehicle Bodhisattvas. But when we lose our confidence or we're not sure, then we're in the middling and lowly and we can't help but wondering, hey, is this going to make it or not? You know, is the hut going to last? Are we going to last?
So not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. So take those couple of lines and investigate a little more deeply. I like Ben's discussion about these directions don't exist as real entities. They really are mental constructs that aren't separate from everything else. They're empty of separate independent being. And when I read these lines, I mentioned a couple of times ago, Robert Aitken's quotation from the Diamond Sutra of Bodhisattva dwells nowhere and bring forth that mind. To me, not dwelling in these directions brought that notion up immediately again. And it's interesting. It turns out that Shirdu's teacher, Hui Neng, our sixth patriot, actually wrote a commentary on the Diamond Sutra. And what he says is that if the mind, the way he translates one of the lines was, if the mind dwells anywhere, this is an abode. And he then comments, if the mind dwells even in nirvana, this is not the abode of bodhisattvas. Not dwelling in nirvana, not dwelling on phenomena, not dwelling anywhere at all, this is the abode of the bodhisattva. Red Pine translates that line, they should not give birth to a thought attached to a dharma, nor should they give birth to a thought attached to no dharma. They should not give birth to a thought attached to anything. So this notion of not dwelling north, south, east, or west is really a fundamental notion of not being attached to phenomena, but at the same time, the obligation, the commitment of a bodhisattva is to be engaged in those phenomena to save all beings. So and that kind of segues to firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. Another way to translate that line is just, again, my friend Paul helped me, just sitting here securely on a firm foundation, that's the best thing, that's the top thing. And it's interesting that the character for steadiness in the Chinese is a roof with a cow underneath it, like a stable. And it's looking, just kind of playing around with that. In English, the word for stable is obviously a structure for lines, livestock, but it's also, it means standing firm, upright. And so in both languages, somehow this notion of a protection for our animals, maybe this is where the ox herding stories lives and is protected from the rain. It's a different kind of hut, but there's something about a stable gives us both stability and a vision of uprightness and protection. And Ben goes on to say that when we sit, as apropos what Suzuki Roshi was saying a minute ago, we make a firm foundation. We make a stable, upright foundation. And in that, we're kind of merging our intention to practice with our intent on practicing with ease and not struggling to attain enlightenment. Because again, the line from the not dwelling in north, south, east, or west is also not to be attached to enlightenment itself, but to practice to save all beings. We're often reminded, Suzuki Roshi, that sitting itself, our practice of sitting is enlightenment. It's not trying to get to enlightenment, that is enlightenment. And we chant an unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma, the incomparable Dharma, and beyond comprehension and understanding. So the steadiness is both a steadiness of practice and a steadiness of emptiness at the same time. Again, one of those kind of paradoxes that seems to be the root of our practice. So let's open up the floor again to this notion of, you know, not dwelling east or west, south or north, and firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. How does this strike you in terms of both the framework of this poem and your lives in practice?
One thing I was thinking about is just steady practice, like regular meditation, would beat intellectual knowledge, studying the sutras and being able to explain things. Just a steady day-to-day meditation practice. And when I think of a cow, I mean, they seem to have kind of a steady, you know, they get up in the morning, they go out, they graze, they come back in, you know, same thing every day, steady routine. Maybe that's stretching it a little bit, but that's what I get out of those lines.
So I'm thinking, this is the original teaching that we get as young new Zen students, just sit. This is where it is. It's firm and it's steady and it can't be surpassed and we can't explain it. It just is. And this is what we can return to over and over, even though in our work in our daily worldly life, there's all sorts of stuff going on in our heads. We know we can come to this. Can't be surpassed. I think that's true.
I'm also noticing that in the merging of difference and unity that Shirtu also wrote, he talks about there are no northern or southern ancestors. And so he might be also referring to that, that there's, you know, there's all these different schools of how you should meditate and understand life in Buddhism. And he's saying, like, no, you don't have to stick to any of those particular paths, but just have your own steadiness.
It's kind of like doing what's before you every day. It's nothing special. It's nothing flashy. It's just life. And that's, you know, and that's, we're seeing the world at that point, I think, is as it really is.
When Dallas, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, surpassed is an interesting word that brings up a couple of other contexts in which we use that. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma. We just said, and then in the four great vows, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So all of that word surpassed, I think, really carries a lot of weight in Zen in general.
When Talis mentioned something about the cow, it reminded, you know, the cows and stables and stuff, it reminded me of this tradition. I don't know where it is, Switzerland perhaps. They have this festival when the cows have been cooped up in the barn for a while and not let out, and so this one day in the spring, they let the cows out and everybody gathers around and watches them. And they charge out of the barn as these joyful, prancing critters, just, you know, getting out. It's just a delightful little story. It reminds me of, you know, just being there to experience that with, you know, in its suchness of its happening would be wonderful.
That reminds me of Suzuki Roshi's image when he talks about having your cow in the pasture and you want to make sure it has enough room so it can graze and have some freedom, but yet you have to enclose it. So, and you have to set some boundaries around it. So that's kind of like that steadiness point, you know, we're somewhere in the middle. There. The other thing that I think is really relevant, at least at our house, where Ben Conley talks about political news. I don't know if you remember this, but he does. And he talks about how, you know, one time you're listening and you're real reactive and you don't like those guys. And then the next time you turn it on and you hear your particular favorite person. And then, you know, then, oh, okay, everything's going to be all right. We feel so positive, which is really timely for us right now. So taking this into everyday life and working with the steadiness in the conditions that we're in right now, for me personally, is really important. And so, and that particular section, more specifically, even.
not dwelling in Republican or Democrat, North or South. Don't dwell any of those places.
I found myself wondering, though, if he would have written that differently today than he did a few years ago. I think the political scene is very different now than it was then.
Maybe not. You know, there was a lot of authoritarian governments in those days.
Well, he was writing, as we said at the beginning of these classes, in the middle of great chaos with the Anlushan Rebellion. So we haven't lived through the kind of chaos that he experienced, and the people who were coming to visit him in his flat stone top monastery hermitage, where people were coming out of great suffering and great duress, plague and famine and things like that, war. But we have our own situation to deal with.
I was thinking of Ben's commentary specifically.
Oh, yeah.
So here he is as a shining window below the green pines. Jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Again, a little help from my end from this shining window is interesting. I when I first read the poem, I thought kind of the reflection of light from the sun or something like that. And it turns out that the character is a character for bright in Chinese. And it's a combination of the radical for sun and for moon, which in the Mahayana kind of translation is the characters for enlightenment, Ming. The word in Chinese for ignorance is Wu Ming, without light, without brightness. This shining window is kind of also the knowledge or wisdom that disperses the darkness of ignorance.
Yeah.
And the last character in the line means inside. So this light is coming from within. It's not being reflected from outside. So as we think about how this has been presented to us and leading up to us, we have this old man, a bodhisattva, sitting inside this room, basically radiating light out of the shack, out of the windows. The next line, the jade palaces or million towers can't compare with it. Ben, I thought was really interesting discussion because he points out your original sort of or initial sense is, of course, sitting here in meditation compared with the realms and the towers and things out down the slope, down the hill by the river, this is far better. But he kind of also points out that the whole notion of comparison in our tradition is kind of problematic, that each has its own place. So one wonders how you take that line, because they're not comparable, and yet they are each of their own nature. So is there a way that we see those towers and palaces as also a place where practice can take place, even though they can't compare with the place where we are, sitting in our grass hut quietly with all things at rest? So others have commented that this line, a shining window below the green pines, jade palaces of vermilion towers can't compare with it, is actually has a kind of an imagistic poetry about it that is really kind of initial in a Zen text. It has a beauty to it that a couple of folks have commented on as being kind of special and unique. So again, let's open the floor for a few more comments and we'll go into breakout sessions in a few minutes. But any thoughts about these two lines?
I just want to underline a little bit about the importance of that character, Bright. And that's actually pronounced Myo in Japanese, and it's very common in Dharma names. So it's like a really kind of important Dharma word. And that it's cool the way it's the sun and the moon together. So it's sort of all aspects of light, you know. So anyway, that's good to point that out.
What about this comparing the, my little hut below the green pines can't compare with the palaces or towers, but do those, where do those towers and palaces fit into the framework of our understanding of how we live our lives?
Oh, I got a question for you actually that connects to that, Bob. Does your, Paul, does Paul say, is the character used for a hut here, which is on, which means
yes.
Did your temple, is there like an ordinary character for hut that he's still not using, or is that just the regular character for hut?
Because we're
actually comparing a temple to a palace, you know?
The translations all are hermitage. There's another, the alternative translation is nunnery, which he said is pretty accurate, but it's not a temple. It's definitely smaller than a temple.
No, it's like, yeah.
We had that discussion. I can query him again. I'm going to see him on Friday, so.
Yeah, I'm just curious, is there like a more ordinary word for hut that was not used on purpose? And so that kind of fits into this comparison thing. What are we really comparing, you know?
I just was struck. I didn't even think about it until I read Ben's text. Well, we don't compare things. So we look at things on their own terms. So it was kind of quite an interesting sort of turnaround that his presentation made.
This reminds me of the Lotus Sutra, where all there's lavish gold, jewels, and everything is covered with gorgeous embellishments and so forth. It takes me into that kind of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Is he just making the point that that's where the light is in the hut, not the towers?
Well, there's some. I think maybe it was Ben or someone else made the point that, you know, to see a jade tower or these brightly Chinese red lacquered buildings would be quite, you know, visually quite stunning, really kind of overwhelming if you were living in grass and bamboo buildings and you saw these things. So I think there's that it's a, certainly a different realm, but I don't know. I'm frankly a little puzzled how we don't see it as comparison, how we do see them as somehow equal on their own terms, or certainly on each on their own terms, I should say.
Would it be to appreciate jade? You'd need light. You'd need that brightness.
I'm kind of thinking of it as, I mean, if there are comparisons, then the way that we can get so easily distracted, kind of, you know, like the crow that's interested in the shiny little baubles, but really it's the simplicity of the hut, the simplicity of looking within.
So this is a good place. I want to make sure we get done on time so everyone has a chance to get a bite to eat. So Ken, do you have those questions I sent you? Can we put those up on the screen or? And who's in charge of making the breakout rooms?
I just sent them to everybody. Hopefully you can open them. If you can't, I will type them in. Just tell me if you need them.
I'm not able to open them.
All right, I will type as fast as I can.
And I can read them as Ken puts us into breakout rooms.
You should be able to copy paste the text, I think, Ken.
I tried, it didn't work. I'm this is my first time through. I will now type fast.
Okay.
You and the original master, is any separation? What is it? How do you settle in your practice? What happens when you let go of all directions, all concepts, all ideas? And do you see your life and practice in relationship to the world of palaces and towers? Opposed to, integrated with, separate from? What is that relationship in your life to the this kind of the glittery life out there around us? So kind of ponder those, and we'll come back in 15 minutes and have a few minutes to, if people want to say a few words about what they talked about, that would be great. So this way we'll be done exactly at 6:30. So into breakout rooms we go. Thank you.
That's a request of...
You're muted. Are you wanting to speak?
Hi.
Hi. Were you in a breakout room and
I
fell out or?
I came too. And you, were you in a breakout room?
No, somebody has to stay behind. So since I'm host, then I have to stay here, but I can move you to a breakout room. You actually are supposed to be in room 8.
Okay, you can move me there, or you and I can just do it. Do you want to talk about it?
Well, I think they're waiting for you. Actually, okay. It's did you get a message that said you need to click something to get a room 8?
No, there's no message to me.
Okay. Well, we can talk if you like. I'm kind of managing controls here too, so I may be a little distracted, but not too much.
So the question is, you and the original master, is there any separation? What is it? Is that what we're supposed to be?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, when I read this, great vehicle bodhisattva, trusts without doubt, middling or lowly, can't help wondering. We're all of that. We're all of that. And so we vacillate between trust or faith and this question of will I perish or not? And it doesn't even matter whether you ask the question because you're all of it. Not dwelling south or north, east or west. So we're all of it and none of it. It's like,
Well, I like how you say it doesn't matter if you ask the question. That was kind of on those two, the end of the previous stanza and the beginning of the new one. That was kind of the impression that I got too. The question that the previous stanza ends on is, will this hut perish or not? And I've been thinking all along that the hut is not perishing, that we're still talking about it, and plenty has been written about it, and it still very much exists. So we think of it as a grass hut that is, a really good example of impermanence, yet many centuries later, it still stands. but then perishable or not. So I think it is a tough question, or a question with no answer. It doesn't matter. There is no yes, it will, no, it won't. They're both correct. But regardless of how you answer that, the original master is present. That's how I sort of interpreted that first line of the next. A lot of these Zen questions are, if you answer yes, I hit you 1,000 times. And if you answer no, I hit you 1,000 times. There is no right answer and there is no wrong answer, but the original master is present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think of the grass part as consciousness, and within our consciousness, there's everything. And because as humans, we're destined to conceptualize all that we're aware of, then there's also nothing, because our concepts it's really hard to talk about. I feel like this poem is kind of pointing us in that direction, though. Uh-huh. The all-encompassing, yet empty. Quality of consciousness.
I liked how on the last line, the Jade Palace's line, the commentary brought reference that koan that I love so much. A monk asked Yunmin, "What is Buddha?" Yunmin said, "Dried shit stick." And I think of, you know, if we're dried shit stick. Or I've heard it translated as dried shit on a stick. But if we're all Buddha, then we're all dried shit stick. And that's, yeah, that's neither good nor bad. And as Ben explains in the commentary, there are a couple of ways of interpreting that. One is that Buddha is not something to hold in, you know, high regard, that's different, you know, separate from everything else. There's Buddha and there's everything else. And the opposite is another way of looking at it, that even the lowest form of something we can imagine, dried shit on a stick, is still, you know, as worthy as Buddha. Mm-hmm. So, but the that was one of the first koans I ever heard when I started practicing Zen, and it's really stuck with me ever since.
I don't know why I haven't heard that. I would have remembered that. Has it been translated differently? Maybe I've heard a different translation than shit stick.
Possible, yeah. But this is similar to the first translation that I had heard. But yeah, there may be some variations.
Jade Palace's room. So this is like the opposite of a shit stick. Jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. It's like elevated or lowly. Neither compare.
I have to say also, I wasn't here last week, so I didn't have the chance to say to anybody, but mm-hmm. I measured this room I'm in.
Yeah.
On a hunch.
Yeah.
And it's 10 foot square. So yeah,
that's small.
I am in the 10 foot square grass hut.
There you are.
And this is where I spend almost all of my time. I sit right here in this seat working. Uh-huh. And I do Zen here. I also have some musical instruments, and so this is my studio. So this is it. And I had a hard time practicing Zen in here because I'm in here so frequently. And you know, I just felt like at the end of a workday, I really need to get out. But this is where my camera is. So, but this really is helping me appreciate that here I am in this grass hut, 10 by 10, and it's palace.
Contains everything. Mm-hmm. All these different parts of you.
And everybody, I mean, here sitting, it really is amazing sitting on Zoom and, you know, in gallery view with all of you, even though it's, you know, my screen is much smaller than 10 by 10, but everybody's right there. The whole world is there.
We're all sitting with you, whether we're on Zoom or not. We're in your 10-foot square room. Yeah. Yeah. This room is about that size, too.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty small. Maybe a little bigger.
So I think there were additional questions, but they didn't make it into the chat.
Do you remember what they were?
I don't know what they are. In the original file that Ken pasted there says breakout questions. So I think they were, and usually Bob asks three or so.
Honestly, I dozed off.
Oh, really?
Yes, I did. I think that's why I kind of, I mean, I woke and I opened my eyes and I was in a breakout room, but then I wasn't. I don't know if I, as I was waking up, I clicked I don't know. But I actually, I, you know how you nod off sometimes in Zazen? I nodded off sitting here.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of fitting too, because there's napping happening here in this poem.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I definitely haven't gotten enough sleep lately.
But I still kind of maintain, you know, the original, the first two lines, I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. And he never says that he wakes up. So I think there is this possibility that the whole poem is a dream sequence. And you know, he's still napping.
Right. Right. Or maybe everything, you know, that passes through our consciousness is like a dream, just completely elusive and not exact and empty of substance.
Yeah. It does. Once I thought of that, the imagery here is very dreamlike. A lot of the things, jade palaces and vermilion towers. I mean, that seems like something that you would dream about.
Just a vermilion tower anyway. I mean, it sounds very majestic, but I don't even know what it is.
I'm not sure either. The commentary said something about red, like it would be red tinted. So it must be a mineral of some sort or, but yeah, I didn't look it up.
Carol, will we be invited back to the big group or do you do that?
We are the big group. So people will come back to us.
Oh, we are.
Yeah.
And I see up there this red button that says recording. Is our conversation being recorded?
It is, in fact. I didn't think to pause. I probably should have paused for break hour.
The people that listen to the recording are they're gonna hear us.
Good thing we didn't say anything offensive. And when I was in here before you arrived, I was in here by myself and it could have said anything, but I didn't. So I guess actually now's a good time. I'm going to invite everybody back. And so they'll all be joining us in a moment.
Okay. Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Darryl, I just got a message from Bob asking you to end the breakouts.
Yep, just did.
Thank you, sir.
So, let's see here, am I? So next week, I think we'll have to start breakout rooms a little bit earlier. So we have a minute or two for people to offer their reflections, but it is on my clock 6:30 and 6:29. And I pledged to be done by 6:30, so everyone could grab a bite to eat because last week we kind of ran over and people were suffering indigestion during sitting. So we don't want that to happen. So thank you all very much. And we have a closing chant.
And should we read the next four lines for next week, Bob?
Yeah. So next week we are going to go from just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? So ponder those lines, read Ben's chapters, and Tim, will you lead us in the closing chant?
Okay, probably everyone else should mute. And then May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And there's unsurpassable again. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, everybody. See ya. Hopefully it's in. It's all in.
Thank you for Tim and Hannah and Ken for keeping everything on track tonight.
Thank you, Bob.
See you soon.